I am Planta on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. In late February, it was announced that the content on SiriusXM's Canada Laughs Channel 168 would be modified from playing 100% Canadian content to incorporating some of the Just for Laughs content that would also include performers from outside of Canada. Comedians in this country were naturally upset as royalties they got from the airing of their work would likely drop. A day or so later, after the intense furor, Just for Laughs and SiriusXM reversed themselves and said they would continue programming Canadian talent. Jonathan Simkin joins me now. He is the president of 604 Records, and over the last year on this program, I've had on a few of the comedians who've put out albums with the label, such as Charlie Demers, Kyle Bonham, and Harris Anderson. I'll ask Mr. Simkin about what his label has done in fostering the local talents like the three I've mentioned, but what they've committed to do, especially in light of the recent news. I'll get Jonathan to reflect on the nature of the record business and comedy in this country. We'll also talk about Comedy Here Often, a worthwhile initiative showcasing comedy through a podcast, YouTube, and more. Visit comedyhereoften.com as well as 604records.com for more. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Jonathan Simkin. Mr. Simkin, good morning.
How are you?
Pretty good yourself.
Good, thank you.
So what all this made us pay attention to is just how precarious the comedy scene is in this country, that if there are people making money, it isn't the performers themselves. What would have this change at Canada Laughs, had it happened, had what Sirius and Just for Laughs had proposed happened, what would that meant to, say, comedians?
Yeah, well, I think it would have meant a few things. I think from a financial point of view, for a lot of up-and-coming and sort of mid-level comedians, sound exchange royalties is a very, very significant portion of their income. And, you know, for anybody who isn't familiar with that, sound exchange is a organization that collects performance royalties for online performances, mm-hmm. but also for satellite radio. Mm-hmm. So when you get half decent radio play on satellite radio, it can translate into, you know, a half decent payday from Sound Exchange. So that was number one. For a lot of comedians who get played on that station, the income was really important to their bottom line. But you know, it was more than a radio station, or it is more than a radio station. It's also really kind of the central hub for development of comedians in Canada, in the sense that it was something, you know, you make a record, and that was something to aspire to.
Mm.
You're an up-and-coming comedian. You try and get into their contest that they have every year, that top comic contest.
Right.
It was really the place where you could go to hear new comedy, where if you were a new comedian, you could hope to get some exposure, get paid. It really was kind of the central hub, as I say, for the development of comedy in this country.
And what was really fascinating about what happened in late February was the outpouring, not only from comedians who were naturally outraged and upset, but from fans themselves, and then that resulted in the reversal by Just for Laughs and Sirius. In the intro, I'll mention that I've had three comedians who've had albums with 604 Records on the show, and it really, I mean, what you've done there at 604, you have had, prior to all of this, a great commitment to showcase Canadian comedy. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, we're relative newcomers to the scene. You know, we're mostly known as a music label, and we continue to be a music label. Mm-hmm. I started getting into the comedy stuff, I'm going to say about 3 years ago. And really, I just saw what I thought was a gap for comedy, especially West Coast comedy. And we had a producer who we work with, who was doing a lot of these comedy albums. And I remember talking to him one night, just sort of saying, you know, what happens to these records once you make them?
Yeah.
And he basically said nothing. And I said, nothing? Like, what do you mean? He said, well, we make a record, they throw it on iTunes, you know, it doesn't tend to sell very well, and some of the comedians sell them at their shows, but you know, most of them don't really have the money to promote it, so they kind of just hope that they get some Canada Laughs play.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was strange. Like, why is nobody really trying to put a little money into this and put a little promotional effort into this? And so we sort of experimented with Kevin Banner. That was our first release. Mm-hmm. And it did really well. And we really haven't looked back since then. I mean, I personally love comedy, and, you know, I love that we were able to make an impact, you know, sort of on the Canadian scene very quickly, which I think speaks as much to the lack of people really doing much in that area as it does to, you know, to us. We didn't do anything different with the comedy records than we do with music. We tried to figure out interesting ways to promote it and, you know, did our best on social media, but, I'm just so pleased that it seems to have made an impact so quickly.
Yeah, and it really does show. I mean, you mentioned the West Coast part of it. Just what a surfeit of talent there is in this part of the world.
You know, just like music. And yeah. I mean, I think in the same way that we were the right label at the right time musically, you know, hopefully we're repeating that again with the comedy side. But yes, there is an unbelievable amount of comedy talent on the West Coast.
And as I mentioned a moment ago, there really is a great community of comedians, not just here, but across the country, and we saw that with the reversal from Just for Laughs and Sirius. The commitment going forward for you at 604 Records, it involves comedy here often. And what does that all entail?
There's a few elements to it. So the first element is the records. That's still kind of the central activity around which everything else is built. But YouTube, our YouTube channel, which, you know, hasn't even been up that long, but I think we're about to crack 2,000 subscribers.
Mm.
That's a real big part of it too, because we, you know, truthfully, comedy records don't sell a ton of copies. It's really more the YouTube stuff that, is, you know, where the monetization, happens. Like, the records do okay, and in the day and age of streaming, I think that's been a real boon for comedy. I think people are a lot more inclined to stream a record rather than to drop $10 to buy a comedy album.
Mm-hmm.
So streaming's been great for it. But really, it's the videos that we shoot, because when we sign comedians, we don't just ask them to deliver an album. We also ask them to deliver video content. That's part of what their delivery commitment is. And that's a huge part of it, just because we're really trying to build that Comedy Here Often YouTube channel. And, you know, you need to feed content. I mean, you know that. You run a blog. I mean, if you got to keep putting those things up, and that's what keeps people coming back. And that's what we're trying to do on the YouTube channel as well. But we're also experimenting with some other things. We're experimenting with some merch items. We're experimenting with, we just did our first Comedy Here Often tour. So really, we're just trying to kind of do what JFL does, but just do it on a very, very, very scaled down basis, you know, and on a real sort of independent basis, in the same way that we've always been a nice counterbalance to major record labels. So we're trying to sort of occupy that same role, but in the comedy world.
Yeah, and the focus remains folks from this side of the country, right?
Yeah, I mean, 604 was named 604 for a reason, and you know, this was all those years ago when we first started, and, you know, we got our seed money from Island Def Jam, from that record label.
Uh-huh.
And the guy who was the head of Island Def Jam at the time, Lior Cohen, who's a very famous kind of character in the music business, he really wanted us to open an office in Toronto or Los Angeles or New York.
Uh-huh.
He really was encouraging us, like, you know, if you want to get in the game, you got to get to New York, you got to get to Toronto, you got to get to L.A. And we really felt like he wasn't understanding it, that, like, we didn't really want to be a U.S. label. We just wanted to be the big fish in the small pond of Vancouver, because there's so much talent here. We sort of felt like, man, if we could be the go-to record label in this part of the world, you know, we're going to do great because there's so much great talent here. And so when we called the label 604. To be to be honest, it was a bit of a FU to to Leorco, and just to kind of say, hey, we're not going anywhere. Like, this is where we want to be. So we've maintained that, and there's definitely exceptions. Like, we wouldn't not sign an act just because they're not from the West Coast.
Yeah.
Like, Coleman Hell, who's one of our bigger Canadian acts, he's from Thunder Bay. I wasn't going to not sign him just because he wasn't from the West Coast. But I would say, both in terms of comedy and music, we're probably 90% West Coast.
Yeah. And the record business today, and I'm not just talking about music, but also the comedy part of it, it is doing well despite the disruption of, say, 10, 15 years ago where everyone was downloading music in the sort, right?
It's doing better. So what's basically happened is we had that kind of period where CD sales just absolutely died, and yet downloading and streaming hadn't really come into their own. So, there was 4 or 5 years there where it was bleak. And, you know, streaming has really been unbelievable. I mean, streaming has really saved us. And streaming, I think, is where we're going in the future. And, you know, I was lucky because Spotify sent out the Spotify program as a beta to a bunch of, you know, quotes, tastemakers in the music industry. And I was lucky enough to be one of those. So I had Spotify probably a year before most Canadians did.
Yeah.
And honestly, within 30 seconds of the first time I was, like, playing around on the format, I was like, this is it. This is the future. Like, why would anybody pay $10 to download an album when you can pay $10 a month to play every album you ever wanted?
Yeah, yeah.
It just makes so much more sense. And you know, it's complicated because I think part of the explanation for the downturn in the music business was that, you know, the record industry treated its own consumers pretty badly for a long time.
Mm.
And I think when the illegal download thing started, when everybody was getting music off of LimeWire and Napster, I think the public was partly looking at it as payback. Like, you've been treating us like shit for so long.
Yeah.
And guess what? Now that you're in trouble, we're not going to help you. And I think part of what's going on now is that people are getting past that. And once again, people are looking at music as something that deserves to be monetized and has a value. And it's amazing to me how great we've done in the last couple of years, mostly as a consequence of our catalog. Mm. Like, we've had some hits, thank God, in the last couple of years, but, you know, like when Theory of a Dead Man had that big hit, for example, like last year, we did really well with it, but the catalog just streamed like crazy.
Mm.
And that's kind of what we're seeing now, is that, you know, every time we have a hit or every time one of our artists releases a new record, all the old records stream.
Right.
So I think people are much more inclined to click on those records when they're not having to pay, like, a specific $10 download fee. And I'm hearing the download store is about to be pulled anyway. Like, I believe Apple's going to pull that within the next couple of months because it's just the numbers are so low now. So even downloads don't really matter as much now. It's really all about streaming.
Yeah. And so do you get, as the president of a label, do you get figures regularly as to what plays well, say, on a Spotify, for example?
Absolutely. I mean, we get accounted to, I think Spotify is, and Apple are both once a month.
Mm-hmm.
Same with Amazon, same with Google Play. And, you know, there's a lot of other streaming companies as well. And that's part of what's exciting. Like, we've, in the last 6 months, done deals with, you know, the three big DSPs in China. You know, we've got a deal with Savin in India. We've got a deal with, I can't remember the name of the company, but the big Russian, you know, streaming company. So there's so many of these companies, and, you know, it's a business of pennies, but boy, there's a lot of pennies out there if you don't know how to collect them.
It all adds up, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah. The Harris Anderson, when his last album came out, was on the show, and we were talking about just how people value comedy now and look at it as an art form. It's a newer art form compared to, say, ballet or other forms of music.
Sure.
But you mentioned a moment ago something that reminded me of what Anderson said, and that is, you know, after the whole illegal downloading phenomena happened, we really started to value the work itself, the art, the comedy. And
yeah.
I think that's why your records have done so well, the comedy records, is because the audience now is hip. They're savvy to just how important comedy is and how much hard work it is, to say the least.
I think that's true, and I think that one of the things that kind of happened is in the wake of this comedy lapse here is that being in the middle of it, it almost felt like a Me Too moment in comedy, because, you know, there was this decision made and everybody reacted, but I felt that it was more than just that. It had a real feeling like a lot of frustration on the side of comedians and a lot of feelings of being disrespected for a long period of time, because, man, people were bringing up stuff that really had nothing to do with serious and, you know, all the times they've been expected to perform for nothing and
right. All
the times they've been asked to showcase for basically no money. And I think the whole community went, enough, like, this is it. Like, we've been treated like crap for long enough, and we're pushing back now. And it's really been interesting in the wake of it, because I think everybody was like, wow, we actually did this. Like, we actually overturned this decision. And now it's in a funny spot, because I think everybody's now kind of going, well, now what? Where do we go from here? Like, how do we make sure this never happens again? I mean, that was part of our thinking in opening up the Comedy Here, often YouTube channel, to third parties, was that we're like, look, we got to do our part too. And if there's people who want some exposure and we can help, let's put them on the site. Let's not just be, you know, piggish about it and only put our own artists on there. We want to do our part to kind of, you know, row the boat as well. And we're in an interesting time now, because I think we're kind of like never going to go back to exactly the way it was. And, you know, sort of in this post Canada Laughs fiasco moment, there's a lot of people now kind of going, where are we? And where are we going? And how do we ensure that we're not so vulnerable in the future, that if one radio station, you know, changes its format, that the whole infrastructure doesn't come crashing down around our heads?
Yeah.
So, really interesting moment in time, I think. It's exciting to sort of be right in the middle of it.
And you must be encouraged as a producer, as a president of a label, to see just how many talented people there are out there.
You know, it's that part, luckily, both in the music side and the comedy side, has never really, you know, been an issue for us. I mean, there's so much artistic action in this part of the world, and I think there's something about being separated from the rest of the country, like physically, that really makes it unique. West Coast comedians are different than East Coast comedians. They just are. In the same way that, you know, West Coast musicians are different than East Coast musicians. And it's sometimes hard to really explain why. I mean, we're all Canadian. We all have shared cultural sort of, not values, but shared cultural reference points. Yet, you know, sometimes I think, man, we're in Vancouver, we might as well be on Mars. It just feels like it's such a different world here, and that's really reflected, you know, in the art that is made in this part of the world. And that's why we've always been so, you know, dedicated and proud of, you know, our commitment to this part of the world. And, you know, if we weren't having success with it, then we might have to rethink that. But the fact that we've been able to help so many artists achieve national and international success is, I got to say, it's a really lovely and satisfying feeling.
You wear multiple hats, but I guess the two main ones is you're president of 604 Records, and then you're still involved managing artists, right?
I guess I wear three hats, really, because, or even four now. But, I mean, there's the record labels, which is really three. There's 604, which is the mainstream label. There's Light Organ, which is the alternative label that has bands like the Zolas. And then there's Comedy Here Often, which has the comedians. Then there's the management company, which at this point is just musicians. We haven't managed comedians. There's been some discussion of that potentially, but we haven't moved into that. And then, I'm still a lawyer. I mean, I still work as a lawyer, and I mean, I've greatly reduced my lawyer workload, and it's not a part of my business I'm looking to expand on. So, but I have two ongoing clients. Uh-huh. You know, I'm in my, believe it or not, I'm in my 25th year as Nickelback's lawyer, which is insane. You know, it's hard to believe it's been a quarter of a century.
Yeah.
And I'm still the lawyer for a producer named Stint, who's doing very, very well. He's a Victoria boy who's now in Los Angeles, nominated for a Grammy year before last, and really doing big stuff like, Demi Lovato and Portugal the Man.
Mm-hmm.
So I kept those two clients just because they're both friends, and I love doing that work. But that's it. Like, other than that, I do work for my own, legal work for my own companies, but I'm really no longer a rent-a-lawyer.
Uh-huh.
I kind of closed that door, 10 years ago. But the law stuff still keeps me busy, especially when Nickelback's active, which they have been recently. They've just been touring Europe and, or sorry, they've just been touring Japan and Australia and some other places in Asia. And, every time they're active, my law practice gets super active.
Right.
So I'm basically wearing, I guess, three hats, manager, label guy, and lawyer. And, throw in the fact that I've also got a couple of kids. My life is a little insane.
It's a busy life, yeah.
It's a busy life.
So what do you tell young people who want to get into show business? Because they must come to you seeking advice as to whether they should or not. What do you tell them in terms of this business that you know so well?
Well, it's funny you ask that. We had a band in yesterday, and I won't say who they are, but we had a young band in yesterday, and it was the first meeting. One of my staff members was quite interested in this band, and I said, okay, well, bring them in. Let's meet them. And so he brought them in, and they came with their dad. They're very young, and I guess they were feeling a little nervous, and so they brought dad along, which, young artists will often do. I have no problem with that. And, the dad sort of asked me the same thing right on the spot. He said, forgetting whether or not you guys are going to do something, just as a father, like father to father, what's your advice? And what I told him was, and I say this to a lot of artists, is, look, now's the time to give it a shot. If it's really what you want to do with your life, and you're 20 years old or 19 years old or 18, now's the time to give it a shot. And what I think, and if one of my kids wanted to get into the music business, I'd probably say, look, I will support you, but you got to devote 100%, actually you got to devote about 200% of your existence to making it work. And there's nothing wrong with setting a deadline. Like, if I cannot make a living in this business by the time I'm 25, I'm going back to school.
Mm.
Give yourself a good amount of time to succeed. And if it doesn't work, don't beat yourself up. Have a plan B. And then go into your plan B. Like, for a lot of people in the music business, they're failed musicians. And I don't mean that in a, shitty way. It's just like, most people don't get to be Carly Rae Jepsen. Most people don't get to be Marianas Trench. In fact, 99.9% of people don't get to do that. So for a lot of people, it's like, geez, I love music so much. And if my career didn't work out, at least I could maybe go and try and be a manager or try and be an entertainment lawyer or try to start a label. So I think that if you really love it, you should also be sort of planning for the possibility that if your career as an artist doesn't work out, you can still maybe figure out another way to be in that business and to still make a living, even if you're not going to be, the person at the center of that as a singer. And, a lot of the best managers I know are people who tried to get into the business. Like, I'm not one of those people. I was a criminal lawyer, and I didn't even take copyright in law school. Like, that was not – I love music. I always have, but it was not on my mind. Like, I was going to be a criminal lawyer, and, in fact, the first 3 or 4 years of my practice, I did criminal law and refugee work, so I did a lot of refugee claims. Uh-huh. I just happened to move into an apartment building next door to a band. That's what happened. It was that fortuitous. It was just a fluke. you know, I for most people, it's not an accident how they fall into the business. And so that's, you know, it's my long-winded way of saying, look, if you're going to give it a shot, give it your everything. Nothing wrong with setting a time limit on it. Nothing wrong with, you know, if you're going to, you know, be in music, then maybe go to Cap University and take their music course.
Right.
That way, if it doesn't work out for you as an artist, hey, you've got some experience, you understand a little bit about management and label, and you can take this thing that you love so much and still be involved, if not as an artist.
I think a lot of people have the idea that show business, because of the glamour and such, that one becomes an overnight sensation because of a particular talent or not. But, I mean, as you just said a moment ago, it's not an accident. It is a lot of hard work, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, for every story where people think it's an overnight success, like, I'm not sure I've ever... There might be a couple of exceptions, but, like, you know, take something like Nickelback, where, you know, before they had their giant hit with How You Remind Me, you know, we spent 4 or 5 years wandering in the desert alone. Like, nobody cared about that band at all. And, you know, they got rejected so many times. You know, or I think of, Carly Rae Jepsen seemed like an overnight success when Call Me Maybe happened.
Mm-hmm.
But that was her second album.
Yeah.
And she had been on Canadian Idol, and she had worked her ass off for years before Call Me Maybe happened. Or Marianas Trench, who... You know, that first album that we did all those years ago, that didn't work at all. I mean, it didn't work at radio.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and none of these things happen quickly. You know, Coleman Hell was a little bit of an overnight success, I guess, because that single did so well so quickly. But even he had been around for a while and had been in other bands. And, yeah, like, people think that there's a lot of these overnight successes. But the truth is, when you examine them, 9 times out of 10, it was nothing even close to what you would call an overnight success. It was usually something that appeared to be an overnight success to the public, but was actually the result of many, many years of hard work.
Yeah. Back to the comedy Here Often for just a sec. The reversal by Just for Laughs and Serious, that was fueled by what people were tweeting about and on Facebook and social media and the sort. So I was wondering, as I was preparing my chat with you today, if you'll ever tweet again.
yes, I will tweet again. You know, I caught myself into a little bit of hot water with the tweet I did last year, and I have a lot to say about it. I'm probably not in this forum, but because I've actually going to be converting my Twitter account to more of a blog account, and I've got a very, very detailed response to all of that that's going to be coming. But, you know, we live in a funny time. Like, we live in a time when you've got all sorts of people who are just kind of like waiting to get angry and waiting to become a mob. And, I ultimately think, like, the Me Too movement and all that is a good thing. Like, I think society needed a bit of a correction. But I think sometimes people get caught up in the crossfire who may be, you know, are getting caught up for the wrong reasons. So all I'll say about it is, you know, I got painted a certain way. And, you know what this is like. Like, it all blew up and then it all went away, like, within a week.
Right.
Like, for 4 days you're an internet pariah, and then people move on to the next one. But, you know, that was hard because my background, of course, there's nothing even mildly racist or ableist in my background. I mean, I was a refugee lawyer.
Yeah.
Like, I used to go to court to fight for people from other countries. And, you know, I got refugees into Canada from everywhere, from Iraq to Palestine to Mexico to, you know, I mean, it's so easy for people to sit on the sidelines and snipe. I was actually on the front lines of, like, actually getting people here. And our company has always been super inclusive. Like, I think when that tweet happened, if you looked at a breakdown of our company at that moment, I mean, I think we had 28 or so employees. And you know how many were white men? 5.
Really? Yeah.
How does that stack up to all these people who are criticizing? Like, I wonder what their companies look like. Because, you know, I mean, there's people in my company who occupy positions of power who are not white men. You know, I've never bought into that. I've always just not given a shit about what somebody's color is. Like, I've hired people based on their skill level. I've hired people based on what I think they're going to be able to do. I couldn't care less what somebody's sexual orientation is, and that's reflected in both the way our employees are, like, you know, what the our employee breakdown is, and also what our artist breakdown is. And it was disappointing that the journalism on that was so lazy, and but nobody really cares about details. They just want to get angry and get clickbait and then move on to the next one. Yeah. So I was more upset in the sense of I didn't want it to reflect on my artists and I didn't want it to reflect on my company. And in that respect, I feel like I let people down. But there was a reason for that tweet, and I'm going to explain it in more detail in this blog. And, you know, look, in the big picture of life and the big picture of my existence, it's a little blip.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate. But, yes, the short answer to that is yes, I'm absolutely going to come back more outspoken than ever. And all the people who were so horrible in the wake of that tweet, I will be addressing that as well.
Well, we'll look forward to that, and then, of course, the work at Comedy Here often. I've kept you longer than I said would, but it's been fun talking to you.
Well, thank you. This has been fun, and you know, I love what you're doing too. And I actually spent a couple of days listening to a bunch of your stuff, and good on you. I mean, you've been doing this a long time, and I think you're really doing some cool work, and you're interviewing people who aren't quite down the mainstream path sometimes, and I really like that.
Thanks, Jonathan. Have a good day.
Yeah, you too.
The website's comedyhereoften.com and, of course, 604records.com. Jonathan Simkin, the president of 604 Records, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunto.